appreciate all of you being here today. Is there anyone here? I guess I'll turn this on. There we go. Since they set it up, I should use it. is there anyone who did not have the opportunity to come to the Doctrine of Discovery presentation yesterday? So a few people have not had a chance to do that. So just I'll keep that in mind when we kind of do a few things. So if you don't know, haven't had a chance to meet me, then I'm Rachel Tabor Hamilton. I am Chacon First Nation, which is a band in British Columbia, part of the Nakola Tribal Association. We refer to ourselves as Chacani. My Chacani name is Jemba Hate. If you would like to call me Jemba to separate me from other Rachels you know, that is fine by me. It's like a G, but like a French J, right? Jemba, that's it. So thank you so much. And also I have an Athabascan name gifted to me, that's Kohojina. The Athabascan language is the language of the Chacani. We're this interesting remnant in British Columbia of an Athabascan migration, from what was interior Alaska. They kind of went through Canada. Apparently, some clans stayed. And then the majority continued a south migration, probably through California, Oregon, and end up in what is today Navajo land. So we're all Diné language in Athabasca. So it's interesting. We have that historical remnant in the language. So now I wanted to just see if someone is willing to be a guinea pig. Can someone raise their hand and be willing for me to just ask you a few questions? Thank you very much. Where were you born?
Boston.
In Boston. And where do you live now?
New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. And how did you get from one place to another?
How did I?
Yeah.
I moved there first to go to college.
How did you get there?
My car.
You drove there?
Yeah.
And thank you. And where do you work?
I work in a church.
How far is your workplace from where you live?
I live in the same place.
You live? That's really important. Most indigenous people will be able to say that they live where they work. It's and especially in traditional time. That they're living in the same place, they're born in the same place, they're going to have ancestors live, die, be buried, and born in the same place. Many indigenous folks practice taking the umbilical cord of a child that's born, letting it dry out, and then doing some herbalism with it and putting it in a very special amulet. And the idea behind that, when a mother does that, is to, it's basically prayers so that their children will stay in place. That they'll stay in place. So sometimes, especially if you see a turtle amulet, that's what's going on. It's like prayers to stay in place or come back home. So that's part of it. Now, what's the longest journey you've ever made?
The longest journey I've ever made? Across the ocean to Europe.
To Europe.
Or to here.
To here. From Boston.
About
that,
the same.
You've done it. You've gone coast to coast on that one. So great. So usually, in traditional times, the farthest that one might travel is during very special festivals where larger communities are coming together so that they have the opportunity to do some very important cultural things together that are bigger spiritual or, you know, religious worship pieces, and also to do some very important tasks that may take a lot of people to do. Many times it's helpful to make for everyone to bring things from their tribal areas, and you kind of do a lot of reciprocity of exchange, right? You're exchanging, I have this from my area, what do you have for your area? So it's a little bit like a farmer's market, but people aren't necessarily like putting it all the stuff in one place. You figure out real quick whose lodge has what kind of product, if they have beadwork, if they're known for the pemmican that they make. You know, you're going to find that out. And you're going to go kind of shopping, and you're going to trade from things that you made or things that you have. So that's one really important, is some commerce going on with moving into one place. Also, in terms of kinship, many times it's really important to come and meet the person that you're going to marry or be with for a while. And in most indigenous traditions, it's up to the woman whether she's going to choose to be married or not, and for how long. She may choose to have a mate for a long time. If things don't go well, she's perfectly capable of picking up and going back home. So just go back home. Not a big thing. And so a lot of that. Where were you married?
I was married just a couple of miles away.
A couple of miles away, so in your heritage territory. Thank you for letting me ask you your story a little bit of travel. Anyone else willing? I want to ask some questions from another example. Okay, we're here in the front row. So where were you born?
Burns, Oregon.
Burns, Oregon. And where do you live now?
Seattle, Washington.
In Seattle. And where do you work?
In Seattle, Washington.
In Seattle. How far do you have to travel to work?
12 miles.
12 miles. How far do you have to travel to go see family?
Back to Oregon.
Back to Oregon.
250-some miles.
And how do you get back and forth?
I take the train or drive.
You take the train or drive. In heritage times, of course, you know, we're traveling by land, and so it's a long walk. So part of it, what you're doing is you're planning the walk, and it takes different amounts of time for people to get to that common place. And so you notice things can tend to be said that they start on indigenous time. Right, Western time is like it's 1 o'clock and we're starting, right? And it's just kind of geared toward that clock. And for indigenous people, we know based on phases of the moon. Everybody's been watching that. We know what month we're kind of in, what lunar month we're in. We know when we're all supposed to usually gather, and so we kind of will go to those. We'll start that migration process to that common area. It might take a few days to get there, and some heritage folks would also have travois. So you kind of create this thing that you drag behind you. And other people had horses, and they could connect their travois to horses. So the domestication of horses happened several times as an independent innovation in multiple cultures, including the indigenous culture. So we know that we had these old-time Paleolithic horses that were around here, and so even the modern hominids were not the first people to kind of domesticate them. We know that dogs could also pull travois. So they were often used, depending on where you were at, to pull stuff around. These days, we put stuff in our res cars, is what we'll call them. And have you ever, anyone here seen smoke signals? Yeah, the best thing about that show is the smoke is the res car that they're in. It can't go in forward, so they go everywhere in reverse. Right, res car, and people get pretty proud about their res car, so what they look like. So. Today, I want to talk a little, today's topic is land acknowledgement. And so I wanted to start with that little exercise just to put us in mind that land is a different concept for those of us who've been shaped by Western culture. That land is a place that we kind of associate with either where we work, where we live, where we, whatever, our family might be, and we have to get there to go travel and see them. For indigenous peoples, because of this really close association with place, and the place becomes where the whole identity of the people are associated. And so in antiquity, all the mythology, all the religious belief is informed by the place. We'll have creation stories about where we came from based on our place, and maybe the nearest sacred sites that we associate with our creation story. We'll also have associated where our elders, where our people are buried. And so those cemeteries are not far, but they're right outside village areas. Many tribes were considered semi-nomadic, which means that they lived one place during fishing season, when it'll be close to where your fish are available at, near the big Columbia River or where. And then in the wintertime, you want to be someplace that's maybe a little bit more sheltered, and you have the ability. My people had pit homes, so those places that were sort of, regular living for several months. Mm-hmm. So they go back, they put on a new roof over the pit home, and everybody knew where everybody was living. Maybe they had babies by now, new family they married into, they got to make some more pit homes, right? Mm-hmm. And then during the fish camp time, and you'll hear a lot of indigenous people talk about fish camp in North America, that was a more temporary shelter, and my folks actually used to make a teepee sort of frame, but with bark. So the bark became kind of shingles that were wrapped around it. But that's all to say that the genesis of every individual nation is very attached to its land. And if we're migrating, it's not far, but even where we migrated to is considered heritage lands. So we have a little bit of space where we're going back and forth. And it's like, you know, in the winter I'm going to go. Today, Western folks, you know, they're kind of snowbirds. So they're living, you know, maybe up here in the summertime when it's really hot in Arizona. And then they'll go back down. So a similar idea, you're kind of being semi-nomadic when you do that. So if you have creation stories and sacred stories, and we have those in scripture, where they talk about, you know, important places like Ararat. They talk about important places like Jerusalem. So a similar idea. People are coming together in those sacred spaces. Other kinds of areas were used for hunting, and that was considered, again, traditional heritage lands. Sometimes tribes would decide more than just one nation might be able to use a similar space. And we've heard about how several different peoples actually use this valley as hunting. And then we're kind of living nearby or closer to Lake Chelan. So this becomes more of a shared territory. So if you take that and you use the parallel, where are your sacred sites? Where are your sacred sites? Somebody just pop some out for me.
Cemeteries.
Cemeteries are sacred sites, yes.
The
cabin by the lake. Places where you really have your spirit nourished. What else?
Beaches.
Beaches are a sacred site for you, yeah. What else?
Rivers.
Rivers are sacred sites. And very many indigenous populations will have water rituals that are associated with specific rivers as well. What else?
The church where I was born and confirmed.
The church where you were born and confirmed, where sacred and special things happened to you. And you came upon, you came onto the planet. Right? So the place we came on the planet and the place we left it tend to be pretty important places. Yeah?
For me, it's the kitchen at my uncle and aunt's house. But at Christmas time, that's where we would all gather after the meal and do the dishes and hang out.
So the kitchen, the place and the home where people are really doing their relationality and relationship. Excellent.
Mountain and high places.
Oh, the mountain and high places. Again, a real common sight, even in Scripture. Old Testament, high places are where you meet God face to face, right? And very similar. So very similar idea. Indigenous people will have, you know, places like Devil's Tower that's associated as a very sacred site. And in the Doctrine of Discovery presentation, I talked about how sites like that, sites like Bear's Ears in Utah, are sites that are very important for Native people that non-Native people would also like to have a part of. And so there can be lots of conflicts around those sacred sites. Now, based on what we just, what I've kind of shared and what you've shared, what would you think, what is your first impression about why land acknowledgement for Native people might be important? Why would you do that? Why would you even think to do that? Why has it become a thing to do?
Yeah. To try to make amends for settlers co-opting it.
So amends?
Amends.
Okay. What else?
Thanks and gratitude.
Thanks and gratitude. Gratitude. Why else?
Preserving your history.
I'm so sorry.
Preserving your history.
Preserving the history. So you're preserving story there. I'm going to use some history. Yeah. What else? Go ahead.
Understanding of the land.
Understanding the land. What else?
Carrying on ceremony.
For ceremony. So there's something kind of ritualistic about bringing that into our awareness, for our practice.
In the medicine of that land, too.
Medicine?
Uh-huh. What the land will give you.
What?
Just healing. Healing.
You can do land acknowledgement for healing for self.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And what else? Correcting history. Yes, thank you.
Education.
Education. That's a biggie.
Setting a bigger context.
Setting a larger context, bigger context.
preserving history, honoring history.
Is it okay if I write honoring the past?
Yeah. And the present, honoring the present too.
Who are you in dialogue with when you're doing a land acknowledgement?
The original inhabitants.
So the indigenous people of that area.
Creator.
With God. Mm-hmm. So you're talking to God, you're talking to indigenous people. Who else?
The ancestors.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to do ancestors and who else? So those present.
Historical colonizers.
So you're talking to the past a little bit? Are you kind of having a communication with the past? Maybe it's part of this corrective that we're talking about. Okay, what else? It's a pretty good list. No one up on the balcony? Okay. So I'm just going to put this in. So there are listeners to every story. And you've named over here what some of the listeners are. We're listening to it ourselves. We're hearing it personally, if we're the person doing it. We're also doing a bit of a ritual. It's a new ritual that we're introducing into a Western practice. We're also preserving a historical truth. And we're communicating our gratitude. What are we grateful for? This is a really important concept. I'm going to put a box around this.
The
stewardship of people who came before us. You're grateful for the stewardship that they provided to the land, okay? What else are you grateful for?
Presence of God in that place.
Thank you. I'm going to say sacred. Is that all right? The presence of the sacred? Okay. What else are we grateful for?
Our life.
Our own lives. That we're kind of living upon this place.
The resources of the land that provide our livelihoods.
The resources of the land that keep us alive. And then who, I just want to ask real quick, who are we talking to right now? We're talking about the past and indigenous stewardship. Who are we communicating with that's outside the room?
Well, I was just going to say, communicating with those with us that are in that place, our community.
With our community. How do indigenous people like me or who are alive today and maybe not in the room when this is happening know that it's happening? Is there a way to communicate that this is happening to those people?
We've got to build relationship.
Thank you. This is all about relationship. This whole thing about land acknowledgement is about relationship. Whether we're talking about relationship to the community that is in the here and the now and is gathered for a moment, or whether it is about a relationship with God or the sacred, our relationship with the land and what it provides and the fact that we're living on it and from it. It's about relationship with the indigenous peoples and our non-native peoples of the past. It's a relationship with history, and it's a relationship with the indigenous people of here and now. So all these kinds of things fall underneath this relationship. So what we're really making when we're doing a land acknowledgement is a statement of relationality to all of these things, our past, our present, and maybe even in some ways it's a commitment just by doing the land acknowledgement to the future, to making the future different from the past. So you also are having a relationship with the future. And living in a way that is perhaps more intentionally aware of all of those things, of our connectivity as communities, and our connectivity with God, our connectivity with the sacred, our connectivity with the land. And that, my friends, is indigenous spirituality practice. Land acknowledgement is essentially inviting non-natives into an indigenous spirituality practice. So it's very appropriate for churches or people of faith, any faith, to bring this land acknowledgement idea. Many times when an idea like land acknowledgement first became popularized, people can maybe jump on that bandwagon without necessarily doing this reflective practice. And they intend well, but it can be a real common, easy rush to an easy fix to make ourselves feel better. And it cannot be that. So don't do that. Don't let anyone rush you to that process or quick get on Wikipedia to figure out who was there. Sit down as a group who are interested to do land acknowledgement and ask yourselves these relational questions. Ask yourself your motivation. Why do we want to do this? And ultimately, there's this interesting phenomenon. During Doctrine and Discovery, I talked about, you know, the perils and dangers and the inappropriateness of appropriating indigenous things, right? But what you're being invited to by me and every indigenous person on the planet is to an indigenous practice of appreciating the land and appreciating its peoples. Because that's a missing from the past. So the corrective for the now and the future is to do it. So really just a nice, didn't take us too long to do that reflective exercise. You were able to very readily list why you might do it. You were readily able to list who you might be speaking to or in relationship with, in communication with. And you were very able and ready to list what you were grateful for. So putting gratitude into the land acknowledgement is number one. You want to be grateful, you want to name what you're grateful for. Number two is acknowledging who and what you're in relationship with. You're in relationship with Creator. Give that sacred a name in your acknowledgement. You're in relationship with what communities? Your own, if you're doing this for a business or a university or a church. You want to name that community. And then you want to name the indigenous communities. In many cases, I'll give you an example. Our Episcopal Church had General Convention in Austin, Texas. It was the last one before the plague. It's been bumped a year. We're having it next year. But the last one we had was in Texas, in Austin. And the people wanted a land acknowledgement to happen. The people planning it. And they didn't know who were the historical indigenous people in Austin. And so they contacted our indigenous missioners office and they asked them that question. And so, you know, even though that was, you know, unfortunately white folk asking an indigenous man to do their work, he did do the research because he was interested because he knew he would be the person asked to provide or identify someone to do a land acknowledgement from the tribe. But here's the difference between a welcome onto land and a land acknowledgement. Super important. Welcome onto land should always be done by an indigenous person of that area. And many times in big conferences, important meetings, that can be a really important thing to do. For the first time ever, the Macy's Day Parade had a land acknowledgement last year. But before they did that land acknowledgement by the mayor, they did a welcome by people representing the historic tribes of that area. So those are two different things. Welcome can be done by the host indigenous people, but land acknowledgement really needs to be done by dominant culture leadership because you're the ones squatting, right? But it becomes not squatting anymore if you get into this relationship. It's intentional, it's choiceful, it's acknowledging the land itself and what it provides, it's acknowledging the people who've gone before, the people who are now, and then being grateful as inheritors of the land that God or the sacred is asking you to steward. You guys here at Holden do a wonderful job of basically, without calling it stewardship, with your garbology and, you know, where everything is and what we all need to do together. That's stewardship of the land. You might not be applying that language, but you're already living into a sense of the importance of that. And then the question about land acknowledgement. So we've talked about the three most important components of a land acknowledgement is why we're doing it. And it's okay to include in there, we're doing it because we want to make the future different from the past. It's okay to say, because we want relationships that are mutually life-giving with one another and with diverse peoples. I mean, really kind of examine your hearts about it. Don't make it perfunctory is what I'm trying to invite you into. And then, many times I'll get a question, do you have an example of a land acknowledgement that we can do at our meeting tomorrow? That's like on the spectrum of really intentional and perfunctory, it's really perfunctory. Now, I would never, on that basis, say to someone, don't do a land acknowledgement until you've done this big process with your community or group. So I do have a handout for you that you can take away with you later that has examples. But they don't do this work, so they're not as meaningful as they could be. But if you find yourself in a fix and you're visiting someplace, it's an opportunity. The first one on this page is actually created by the Episcopal Indigenous Missioner. And he used it when we had him as a guest speaker at our diocesan convention that was virtually held last year. So he's gifted this one to us as a general acknowledgement. And it gives a little bit of the outline that we've talked about here. So if you find yourself stuck, okay. Then this one, someone else gave me, a non-Native person gave me. Look how it is fill in the blanks. How Western is that? But I kept it because this is from the Indigenous community and this one's from the Western community. But you can look at them both. There they are. But then together, you know, creating this other way of doing it. Now, then people say, I don't know. Now, getting back to the Austin example, we discovered who the heritage people were in Austin, and we discovered that they were no longer in Austin. There were no representatives in Austin in the urban area. There were no representatives in Houston. In fact, most of the indigenous populations that would have been semi-nomadic to that area are extinct. Okay? Now, we talk about extinction as something that applies to animals or plants or species of various kinds. But we know many, many tribes are extinct. Yesterday, during the DOD presentation, I showed you a map of what is now the United States, and it just has people everywhere. 90 million people before Europeans came to Turtle Island, which is North and South America. 90 million people were already here, living here for centuries, millennia, and had advanced civilizations. So part of what we might want to include, and just think about, is the grief around that past. Yesterday, I was grieved by that, just talking about it. Other people in the room were grieved by that past. And so, when we talk about amends, we might want to also talk about feeling how bad we feel, that we have grief. We do land acknowledgement so that we do something positive and productive with our grief. Christians are into repentance, but that doesn't do a whole lot without action that follows up. And that action that's most meaningful is building relationships. So there's no extinct people in Austin for the Episcopal Church to have a relationship with. Now what do we do? Right? And it basically means carrying that past in a way that makes us aware of it, carrying it intentionally, talking about it all the time so that that doesn't happen again in the future. And then what can happen is one opportunity, the first time you do a land acknowledgement, it can be very powerful to invite indigenous people to it. And to actually involve them in a process beforehand. And I don't mean that it's their job to write it. It's our job, you know, to write, the organizational job to write. But then having a conversation and just saying, you know, we've been working on this. And it's important to say why, because of all these things. And we seek relationship with God and you and our past and ourselves. So we put this vulnerably in front of you as our nearest tribal peoples and say, what does this convey to you? And let them reflect back to you what you're offering to that. And that vulnerability is a super important part. You're not asking for their approval. You're asking for relationship. You're inviting them into your vulnerability. Do you hear the difference? Again, Western society wants to say, put your stamp on that. We're not asking for imprimatur. We're saying, this is where we are with this. What is this saying to you? All right. Now, the ultimate goal of a land acknowledgement then is to build relationship with actual indigenous peoples who are in your area. And you might, as a part of this that can be very important as well, is name those action steps. So a land acknowledgement that concludes with actions or commitments, because commitments are important. And commitments can be, you know, we will always remember this past. We can, you know, do a memorial. But what can be more meaningful for building relationship is what you're pledging yourselves to do in the future. For example, in a land acknowledgement I'm aware of, it's actually Sale University. They recognize they have multiple indigenous students. So at the end of their land acknowledgement, before it signs off, they say, we pledge to our indigenous students that, you know, we will, as educators and administrators, provide intentional ways of them being supported and valued and welcome into all aspects of the university life. That's an important commitment. And then they suss that out in another document that's an internal document as to what that commitment means. And so Holden might, for example, have a commitment that says, we commit to having, you know, regular meetings with tribal leaders to work on issues of stewardship. You put that in your land acknowledgement as a commitment at the end. So land acknowledgement, it's about what we do with all of this stuff here and now to build these relationships into something that are sustainable over the long haul. Many times what will happen is that phenomenon I talked about yesterday in the DOD, which was, we'll send mission trips to other places, you know, let's all go to Standing Rock and build a schoolhouse, and then we leave. And there's no way of sustaining that relationship. So please don't go on mission trips unless your organization or you have a long-term commitment. Because that's one of the things that Native people understand quite well. That they become used as a piece of spiritual commerce for others. And it's not about relationship, it's about those who are coming and needing to feel good. Right? So we don't want any of these actions, again, to be perfunctory. It needs to be connected to the future commitments. That this is for the long haul. We're invested in doing the following kinds of things. Any questions so far? Yeah.
And this may take you off track of the, so if we need to check to understand. But in Seattle, maybe somebody from the area, I've noticed that a number of the churches have in their bulletins or they have signs where they say, you know, we acknowledge that this is the land of the Duwamish. And I'm not familiar enough about what's behind that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Duwamish, thank you for that question.
And, you know, I mean, did they go through, have the churches gone through a process such as you're describing, or?
Most of the churches who have doing that have not gone through the process that I'm outlining for you. They've done it internally. They haven't necessarily talked with indigenous people. They're doing the easy out. The Duwamish, though, aren't, you know, they're interested in relationship too, believe me. But one of the things that they've created, because they've been, you know, get this question a lot now, how can we, you know, acknowledge your land? And one of the things that they've created is real rent.
Yes.
Real rent program, so that organizations can send money of an amount of your own choosing, and it can be part of your acknowledgement that you're doing that, and you send donations. And so it falls under now a line item for them called real rent. And they use that money to help tribal peoples and create scholarships, so it's an exchange of goods. They also, like the Suquamish, have, you know, enough income of their own that they'll do grants to other organizations or businesses that serve the community to help them do that. So there's ways that you can also think about, you know, developing future partnerships as part of your, you might not have to know, name them now, but we're creating a partnership program, an intentional looking at where we can work on tribal issues of social justice, whether it's around access to water or land rights, land use. Those are two huge big issues. In the state of Washington, we have tribes that are not federally recognized, and it's a dominant culture piece about why not to do that, because it's expensive. If you're actually going to keep a treaty as a U.S. government, it means in those treaties that you have promised to provide funds for education for every single member of the tribe. You've agreed to provide health care for every single member of a tribe. You've agreed to allow them to protect their own boundaries to a certain degree. The FBI can go anywhere, and that's a problem. Some tribes are not allowed to persecute non-Native people who come on to the reservation and commit crimes. And so that's another big issue that you can ask about. Another one is basically in the past, abducting children to go to boarding school. Child abductions still happen, and they're pulled out and adopted out to other people, rather than working on the issues that created the problem in the first place. Indian health is underfunded, understaffed, and it's the only thing that most Native people have access to. So even inquiring, those of you who have medical backgrounds, you know, is it helpful to offer your expertise on a volunteer basis sometimes? On certain reservations, that's a real need. On others, it'd be more like a partnership. Hey, you have a couple of docs, can I be on rotation? You know what I mean? So there's just other ways. Think about it as the reality is, and the respect is, you're asking for a relationship with a sovereign nation. If you wanted to have a relationship with Poland and can't, and you know, suddenly y'all decided here at camp we needed to have a relationship with Poland, you would talk about how you would do that. You would talk about who would be your best ambassadors. You'd talk about what kinds of ambassadors you'd need to connect with. What are your interests? You'd have researchers looking at what are the issues over in Poland so that you know where to interface, where you have skill sets. They may have skill sets you don't have. Maybe you have your naturalist may have an interest to know about indigenous woodland lore. So you begin to make your list of needs that you have, because relationship goes both ways. It is not about approaching indigenous people as though they're empty vessels that you're about to fill with your wisdom, but rather that they have full buckets and you have full buckets. And in that economy of reciprocity, what can you give one another? Because that's where indigenous relationship building begins. So all of that exchange, just keep thinking about getting out of an economy of capitalism in your head that takes many forms, and get out of the more patronizing Christian ideas of mission, and talk more in terms of partnerships, relationship development, and reciprocity. Because all of those things are going to be meaningful to indigenous people. And you'll want to make sure you do have researchers. You want to make sure you do have people who are doing the historic digging into what was Washington or this area before occupation. Because that's how indigenous people talk about y'all. You're not immigrants, you're occupiers. Okay? So, because you represent an empire and a historical empire. So, and many times when I'm with indigenous people, we still talk about conquerors. Well, the conquerors think this. So just know that they're not going to necessarily say, thank you, welcome, I'm so glad you're here to help us. They're not going to do that. So it really needs that research and relationship building and thoughtfulness and intentionality and listening. You guys are doing a great job. You did a great job yesterday. But being willing to be in the learner mode. That's another Western thing. We're kind of used in the Western thing. On my father's side of the family, having degrees was super important. Man, you didn't have to tell your life story. You just sat there, I have a PhD and blah, blah, blah. You know, and be, oh, you know, and people kind of back away. That's not how. It's going to be much more like that doesn't entitle you to anything. They don't care about those. What they care about is if you come alongside. So rather than approaching them and says, I have something to say to you and teach you, it's coming alongside. This is the indigenous education model. And just watching. Not even saying, what are you doing? Just they're not going to tell you, they're going to show you. So you just watch. Just sit quietly and watch. And if I guarantee you, if you do that enough, if you just sit and watch and sit and listen to the stories that are being told and sit and see how the children are interacting and cared for, you just sit and listen and watch. You're already putting yourself in the indigenous modality of learning. Because they're not going to have an academic conversation with you. They're going to just live life. And if you're interested to learn it and you show that interest, eventually they're going to hand you some supplies of your own and you're going to start being expected to do it. So that's another thing to know. If you get in a relationship with indigenous people, they're going to have expectations of you. Do you want to have them have expectations of you? If you're going to get involved in social justice issues, do you want to have the expectation of having to show up at certain court dates just to sit there? If you have a collar, sit there in your collar. If you have an important business suit, you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, show up in that. And just be present. Because you can be phenomenal allies, very important allies, just simply by that ministry of presence. Showing up when you're asked to. Showing up. If you are asked to an indigenous funeral, I don't care what else is going on in your life, you're going to go to that. Remember when I talked, when you arrive on the planet, when you leave, are two huge important moments culturally? So if you're invited to show up, be prepared to show up and be prepared to be there all day. This is not a Western, I got to leave at 3. No. This is, oh, everything stops and I'm going to go here and do this and be available and be present. Even if what I'm doing is just sitting there in a chair for 3 hours, I'm going to go and I'm going to do that and they're going to see me and it means something. Because it's the relationship expectation. So, any questions now? Yeah?
Can you say a little bit about the history of this practice and its origins? Because I know a lot of times, sometimes like non-native or dominant culture will identify practices that they think are meaningful or helpful their own.
Progressive white guilt isn't all bad. It has a place.
But I'm just thinking that's whatever that story is might be helpful to tell when we're doing this work.
Well, it's real interesting. It actually did come out of more of academic university settings first. It was sort of being developed there, being shared there among administrators as they came together. And coming out of places, for the most part, that have a real sensibility of indigenous presence. So Bismarck. I think also out of Maine. The only reason Maine did is because of the Penobscot. They were doing some really intentional work between the government and the Penobscot. And then again in Seattle University. So it kind of comes out of that setting and it does come out of a desire to deeply look at racism, institutional racism. It looks at how do we need to be more actually helpful to our students who are diverse students. How do we actually need to communicate differently with their families? How do we need to accommodate different cultural expectations? Because the European yardstick isn't the only one in a diverse setting. And that's another thing in the churches, right? Especially in the ordination process. And basically, in the Episcopal Church, the Church of England literally created the yardstick, right? England created the yardstick by which all others are measured, quite literally. And so right now we're going through this process of how do we do some cultural accommodation? And we certainly have expectations of meeting certain professional standards on that, but how can we do that in a way that's authentic to someone who's come to us from Gambia, to someone who's come to us from the Iroquois? So it's just, it's a willingness, I think, it comes out of a place, and its best intention, it comes out of a place of wanting to do those historical correctives and address issues of systemic racism. So that's the positive part about it. But what I want to make sure doesn't happen is that it just gets used in that most superficial way. That it really, you understand that if you're going to do it, you're obliging yourselves to a relationship. And it needs to be intentional, and you need to create action steps that are attached to it. Even if it's continuing to invite different Indigenous people into your circles. Yeah.
Rachel, I just want to add that Tacoma, Washington became aware of all the land that was stolen from the Puyallup.
Yeah.
And has been returning that. So the Port of Tacoma was stolen from the Puyallup, but it was returned back to the Puyallup. In this awareness and land acknowledgement, all city activities or concerts are started by a Puyallup tribal member during the land acknowledgement. This has become the norm. But as a teacher, I love it, and I really appreciate that the self-esteem of our Native students has improved and increased as a result.
So what she's talking about,
really what this is all about, is helping all of us to live together healthy. And with access to our resources.
It's another motivation, is health, right? Health.
Yes.
Communal health. Now, so if you didn't hear, she's talking about the example of the Puyallup and the city of Tacoma. In giving, even part of their action plan was to actually give land back. And they gave back the port?
Yes, the port of Tacoma.
The port of Tacoma. Yes. Right. And so when they do large events, you're saying a part of their welcome and land acknowledgement is also involving an Indigenous
right.
Puyallup.
So usually the first 15 to 30 minutes of any event, major big event in Tacoma, will be with a land acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
And on every other Thursday at our schools, there are tribal members that come in to teach Native arts and crafts.
That's great.
And to work with Native students.
So there's a real commitment.
And all of us love to participate in that, and there's not always enough room.
That's
if kids do have priority for that, I'm always like, but I got that 15% Cherokee. But it is wonderful, and to hear the drums at school is just, it's a joy.
And I love what you said, that it raises the esteem of Native students, because one of the things I mentioned yesterday was the high incidence of teen suicide. Between the ages of 10 and 35, that's the highest rate of suicide that's disproportionate for the amount of population that we represent, so as well as incarceration. So sorry.
As you're bringing up that issue, I'm thinking of the tragedies that occurred recently
in Marysville. Yeah. An Indigenous teen who commits suicide and, you know, came in violent, another shooter. Yeah. So
this is a happy story.
Yes, and I've also been in Marysville, and it's very sad. My daughter's best friend, Ava, that came with us today, is Tamila. She does live on the tribe. And she's not participating in any of that. She's chosen not to. We've talked about it. But it is hard. And it's interesting the way the two different tribes look at each other. Her father, who is a tribal member of Tulalip, actually says, well, the Puyallup are the next Indians of Vermont.
Can you speak up?
Oh, sorry. The Tulalip, my friend is a Tulalip tribal member, and he says that the Puyallup are the nice Indians. Where the Tulalip, instead of getting their land back the way Tacoma has done it,
the Tulalip have had to buy their own land back, and the Duwamish are actually not federally recognized.
Yeah.
So there are issues to continue to advocate for, and they recently have had some greater success. But we have to get it passed in courts of law in Washington. So there's so many ways that you guys can be involved in the action plan that you might create, whether it's through education opportunities that go both ways, through opportunities to identify local tribal members who'd be willing to work with you on developing programmatics that are diverse, et cetera, and so forth. So all of that. So that's kind of in a nutshell. Now, one of the big pieces that people will ask is, again, we don't know who lives here. You know, who was on Whippy Island before I was? Coast Salish peoples, still a Guamish. So they used that as fish camp. But there was another group of Salish who stayed permanently almost year-round at what was Eby's Landing. Eby's Landing is one of those places that has a piece of history to it. When Eby was there, some Tlingit came down along the shore and chopped his head off because he was an important leader in the area. And what had happened was some military personnel had killed one of their important leaders. So they were simply looking for another equal to a chief. And he was considered a man of high status. So anyway, there's lots of, learn about the history, the tribal history of your area and of your church. One of the things that was said by Asa yesterday that I thought was very important is he talked about how churches and Christian organizations are outposts of empire. So churches, I believe, can have a very important role in establishing healthful relationships with indigenous people for that reason. And become a place that no longer represents empire, but represents genuine transformation. So again, going back to how do you find out who actually lived there before? Because they may not live there anymore. They might not even be a surviving band or tribe anymore. And so one of the biggest things I like to, that you can pick up and take away, is this talks about how Washington State has 29 federally recognized tribes, and then has those who are not. It lists them here. It talks about the Chinook and Duwamish and all that. It also talks about how it's important, and this might be an action item you want to do, to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. When is Indigenous Peoples Day?
October 12th.
October 12th. It's thou shalt not practice Columbus Day anymore. If you're going to have this relationship. Okay? Because it's basically like saying, we love our Jewish neighbors, but we celebrate Hitler. That's the impact emotionally. So you have to choose. There's some changes that you'll be asked to make down the road and other things you might realize become valleys instead of the bridges you want to build. So sometimes you might have to be willing to fill in a valley. And you might stumble over things and it might be messy and it's not going to be perfect. But perfectionism is a Western illness. Learning is the cure. Just being in learning modality, being willing to be vulnerable and not know, and simply to listen. So in some ways, taking up a spiritual practice of relationship with indigenous people is asking you to be mindful of your culture, and how your culture may be antithetical or counterproductive to what you're trying to achieve. So it's just being willing to change that, learn a little bit, hang out. Now on here, this handout, is a website link that you can go, and it's run by Indigenous Peoples in Canada, and any Indigenous people can contribute to it to keep it updated. It's still a work in progress, right? But it will, you'll be able to put in your zip code, your exact address, and it will tell you historically who was associated with that land. So that's an app that you can get, and it's run by tribal folk. Okay? So that is the bulk of what I had to share with you. Is there anything that, yes?
A couple of things about what you just mentioned. I know that there's a, because we use this at our cabinet meeting, there's a phone number that you can text your city and state to, and that will immediately send you a text message of
where you are. Yeah.
So there's that.
Do you know that, the name of that? You have the phone number. Here, okay, so go ahead and give us our phone number.
Oh, boy. That'll take me a minute.
Okay, you take a minute.
Yeah, but the other.
And you have it as well. What's that?
907-312-5085.
So wherever you are, and it knows where you are because your cell phone GPS is on.
You just texted.
You texted.
The zip code
of where you are. All right, so let's put that number up there to them. 907-312-5085. Thank you. And then another thing, this is a really recent resource that's just come out. Not very old at all. It's called We All Go Back to the Land. And it's a really good resource that really outlines in more detail what I've shared with you and additional things as well. But this goes deeply into what you can expect as you build relationships with tribal people, issues to be aware of that may be cultural differences in general, and knowing that the doctrine of discovery is something that all Indigenous people across the world hold in common, and so their first encounter with you is very important. And how you approach them, are you coming alongside because you want to learn? Or are you approaching them face to face because you think they owe you a relationship? They don't owe you a relationship just because you want one. So it's just being patient, being committed to the long term, and being willing to be by their side. And then when they do call upon you, you do whatever it takes to answer.
What is the title?
This title is We All Go Back to the Land. If you didn't get a chance to pick up, it's listed in my Indigenous resource list. A lot of people picked that up yesterday. But if you didn't get one, I'd give you one today. But it's on there too, along with everything else. Yes?
So I'm one of the executives of the United Methodist Church in Oregon and Idaho. And one of the things that we deal with is churches closing. And churches are closing more and more now, all the time on the foundations. And when our church in Wallawa, Oregon closed, the bishop said, shouldn't we think about returning that land back to its original inhabitants? And so we did some research because we had already done that to a piece of land at Wallawa Lake, camp that we have at Wallawa Lake. And it fell within the original 1865 treaty boundary there as a first.
Yeah.
And so the long story short is we very carefully, through a Native American pastor that serves in our conference, had conversation and relationship with the tribal leaders and the council as a first land we had. And just recently held a ceremony where we actually deeded the land back to the tribe.
That's powerful.
And you know, that's a matter of if you will, giving up resources that we could use for other things in the church. Mm-hmm. But we decided that this was a really important thing to do. And it has created ongoing relationship and friendship and humbleness and
Yeah, you said an important word there, you know, approaching it with humility, approaching the relationship. You're approaching a sovereign nation, and so the humility piece and the long-term relationship. You went through several steps very quickly about, you know, before you even got to the place of giving land back. For that to be truly meaningful, you need to begin to grow that relationship in consultation now. There was a bishop in British Columbia, Anglican bishop. The church structure is different there. If an archbishop says something is going to happen, it says that. It just does. And this particular bishop said, when he came on into that role, he saw the extreme poverty and the rural issues that were going on. And he basically, as a collective, he said to all the tribal leaders, all the church lands are yours if you want them.
Wow.
Only three churches were received back out of 60-something. Because the rest were just like, thank you, just even making that gesture. Now, of course, he wasn't popular among his fellow bishops because they weren't going to do that. But it was a very powerful witness that's remembered to this day in British Columbia.
Yeah, that's a really great thing about our bishop, because she is very cognizant of that. And a supporter of that.
Yeah.
And we were really careful to ask.
Yeah, to ask.
And
not assume that they would say thank
exactly.
you.
Right. And because they had a powwow in that town,
they determined,
not us, that they would, they have a vote to receive.
Yeah. Thank you. Overall, what I notice about the church is this, and this, I was literally told one time, Well, Rachel, you know, we can't change how our church is operating, you know, because we're really obliged to our heritage, which is, you know, this Western European thing in the Church of England. And by the way, you know, I wouldn't be in my position if it wasn't God's will. And so obviously I know what needs to be done, or I wouldn't be here. I've literally been told that. And it's the institutionalism of paternalism. And making it God justified, and making their worldview more important than mine, or more real, or more valued, more viable. And so we've gone through this whole time over the past couple of years of really trying to get to the heart of where that's coming from, and it really ends up being protectivism, right? That the mainline church, dominant culture church, often will simply want to protect what it's comfortable and familiar with. Why? Because that's their culture. So if they want to be a diverse church, they have to start letting go of having everything always look like them, what they're comfortable with. How many times have I been told, oh, Pastor, we can't sing that song, no one knows it. Stretch. Just stretch. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of any of people on an individual level deciding to bequest their home if they own a house? As they do their end-of-life planning and their wills, and maybe just selling it and giving the money to the tribe, or offering it, or
so
something
I've heard,
like that?
Thank you. So she's asking, is there an example of people willing their, deeding their land over privately? So there's really interesting United States law that basically, in many states, says you can't do that. Guess why? Because, you know, yeah, and because it's basically in back. The other big thing, though, is I do know of an example where a guy who had a cabin on land for a long time that was part of national parks, and they sucked it up, really irritated park services by deeding the land to the native people. Because that's a real movement, too, that you might want to know about and get involved with, is park service land. And, you know, why is that being held by our government? It's for everyone's enjoyment, right? But it's like, no, what else is happening there? How can we do it? There's a piece of Grand Canyon that is now stewarded by a local tribe. And there, you just hear all this paternalism and critique about, you know, Native people, they don't know what they need to do. They're not possible doing it. The Macaw wanted to make their own curated museum on the Olympic Peninsula. And the rigmarole that they were put through to have their own museum and get items repatriated, which is another thing you might think about getting involved with, repatriation of sacred items. They had to do 3 years worth of process. They had to demonstrate and prove to other professional museum curators that they knew what to do. On and on and on. That relationship is not at all equal, right? But so there's so many things to just look at, imagine about what might be possible. And you all here at Camp Holden, at Holden Village, may want, this is another important thing, you may want to create a permanent display that talks about the history of this place. You know, I totally get the mine thing. You guys have done a great enculturation of me. I get what's happened to the copper mine and all the remediation. That's amazing. And what happened before that? So the history didn't start when the white people got here. Mm-hmm. So part of one of your action projects might be, after you, in part of that research and on and on and on, and finding historical photos and archives at universities and at tribal offices, and just create just a small, doesn't have to be huge, take up a building, but a small entry-level display. Mm-hmm. Anything else? The one thing I didn't mention at DOD that's a big deal has to do with what's called blood quantum. In all the different ways that indigenous people have experienced genocide, blood quantum is the most insidious genocidal tactic of the US government and Canada. So what happens with blood quantum, and we're the only minority that has this issue. Any other minority can say, if they have a 16th of blood, you know, I'm Asian, identify with that, I'm Mexican, I'm on and on and on. But indigenous people have to prove by how much blood they have whether they're native in the eyes of the government. And the reason for that has to go back to those treaties. have to provide education and health care and other kinds of funding to Native people. So how do you not have so many of them? By attrition, by blood thinning, by saying anyone with less than a quarter cannot be recognized. Now, the Cherokee said, uh-uh. And they basically have thwarted that law, and they have travel cards for people who can simply demonstrate their Cherokee heritage and where they came from. Others, because of those laws and because of the limited access to needful funding, are very protective of that piece of pie. And so they'll have much stronger, but it has to do with limited resources being offered by the government that they have to curate. And so it's not because they're being stigmatizing, it's because they can't afford that. They have limited numbers of people. So what that also means is that people, indigenous people, often intermarry. I have my friend Darren Chittister in the Episcopal Church who has like 5 different tribes in his background because of that necessity to intermarry in the other tribe. So know that when you approach an indigenous person and you say, hey, I have a story in my family and it makes me 1/15 Cherokee or 1/15 something else, Navajo, that you want to be cautious. What's the claim you're trying to make? Are you claiming to, you know, the rights to indigenous culture? Because that's often been so manipulated to justify appropriation. So just know that the whole issue of blood quantum, we lose on both ends of the spectrum. If we don't have enough blood, we don't get entitlements that were due because of treaty rights. And if we have too little blood, but we are highly enculturated into our communities, then we can be suspect in the eyes of other Native people. I have a dear friend who has grandchildren who are Apache, but they don't have enough blood quantum to be considered Apache. But she goes out and she says, they're fully Apache and I'm teaching them everything. They're gonna be Apache, whether you call them that or not. Then they know how to fancy dance and the whole nine yards. So it creates issues as well. But so just don't think that you're establishing a good connection when you make that claim, even if it's true, because it's just so laden with history and trauma and potential appropriation. You know, you can remember how it ran into with Elizabeth Warren? She made a mistake of just saying that. It was true. It's true. But she's never, it's long distance, it's through time, she's probably got low blood quantum, doesn't matter, but she's not enculturated. And she's not recognized by tribe or by family. And she did say that. I never benefited from it, I never blah blah blah. If you want to benefit from it, you better understand the suffering because of it. Have you lived this suffering? Have you dealt with that? So it's just, you know, being cautious about how you approach it is what my morality story is there. But if you do know that you have indigenous heritage, explore that. Learn about it. Relate to it. And let it inform you in ways that are meaningful and appropriate for you. But don't make claims until you have a relationship. And then be willing to be taught. I thank you for your time. You've been gracious and very listening to me, and I appreciate it. Thank you. And don't forget your